Hello, and welcome to Sesquicentennial Stories, a deep dive into the history of Alaska before, during, and after the Alaska Purchase in 1867. Our goal is to tell the story of the 49th state from as many viewpoints as possible, presenting you with some twists on stories you know, and hopefully learning something new along the way. This series is sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and in the first part of my conversation with Ross Cohen, we discussed Alaskan cities being built up out of nothing. In this episode, we discuss the specific challenges that present-day Alaskan cities have, and later on in the episode, we talk about the history of segregation and exceptionalism in the Alaskan city, a story that continues today. I asked Ross to name what he sees as the biggest threat to the Alaskan city.
One that immediately occurs to me is electric power generation, and this is particularly acute when you get off-road, when you get out into rural Alaska, where each village, you know, has its own power plant, its own diesel generator, and so each community, there's no grid, right? There's no power lines connecting these communities. Each community is its own base of both generation and consumption. And that creates enormous challenges because one of the things that makes an electric grid economically viable and even competitive is when you can connect a number of different users, both residential and commercial, governmental, whatever you have you, like along the rail belt, you know, or in a larger community such as Juneau or Sitka. And of course, you have hydropower down there, which is an entirely other sort of animal. But in reference to your question, one of the main challenges then of rural Alaska has always been this issue of power generation. How can it be made economical to import diesel fuel, run this generator for only the select businesses and homes and schools and clinics or what have you who are there? Not necessarily a paying proposition. And so it's always been a challenge figuring out how to solve that. Now, one of the things that I think is particularly interesting, when the federal government in the 1930s really began to subsidize power generation through New Deal programs and so forth, they made loans, low-interest loans, guaranteed federal loans to communities who wanted to put in this electric infrastructure. Now, that program was not extended to rural Alaska really until the 1960s, and it was really the 70s and 80s with the influx of oil dollars that process really took off. But what I think is most interesting about it is that the Rural Electric Administration, from that's the federal agency that managed this process, they wrote into the right-of-way agreements with rural Alaska communities that communities had to have local people serve on the board. They wanted to see locals contribute something, make some sort of in-kind contribution. That might be the use of a loader. That might be a plot of city land that is given over to house the generator and the electric lines, things like that. And in those right-of-way agreements, the federal government explicitly says that these requirements are for the social, political, and economic development of Alaska Native people. Essentially, power generation in that context was not simply about bringing electric lights to a village, but it was about providing a structure by which Alaska Native people could have access to the political and economic institutions of the state and the federal government in a way that they had not had that before. This is very representative of, you know, the New Deal progressive philosophy in the 30s, and then again with the Great Society programs of the 1960s, right? The use of government investment to, for the purpose of solving social problems or achieving social goals. Very common of the time. Today, that's, of course, fallen out of favor a little bit, but very common of the time. So to cycle back to your question then about challenges with which cities develop in Alaska and the ways in which they're different from others in the lower 48, it again comes back to those environmental challenges, the sheer distances that have to be crossed, but then also the manner with which public institutions, the state and the federal governments, have participated in that process, not merely to build roads or buildings or bring electric power to villages, but for the purposes of social uplift in those communities.
I've spent some time in Yakutat and Cake in the past few years, and I've had conversations with people there who told me that the young people there, because of cable TV and the internet, are being introduced to life away from Alaska and all the, you know, the shiny new things of the lower 48, and are being pulled away because of that. But the problem is that sometimes they're not coming back. A woman in Yakutat just came out and said, you know, we just don't have the infrastructure here. It can't happen here. And so it's either too expensive or the internet goes down and our city is dying because people are moving away to places where there is better infrastructure. Are we at a point now that people aren't really talking about where things are changing for Alaska, for the Alaskan city? Like, somewhere something's going to have to adapt, and it's happening or not happening?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I think whether or not that discussion is happening, I feel as though that discussion is often disconnected from these historical antecedents that I'm talking about, right? That is to say, if Yakutat is changing, if Cake is changing, for the worse or for the better, however that's viewed, those changes are taking place in this long sort of continuity with the past, right? I mean, power, power generation, like I just mentioned, might have been brought into a community in a particular way. And so understanding the history and the legacy of how that specific change happened, I think can inform the changes that are still happening today. That is to say, there's never a break with the past. It's never as though things are happening now in a vacuum the way they've never happened before, and there's no connection, no continuity with the past. That's not the case at all. It's intriguing to hear the way that you describe what's happening in Yakutat and Cake, and I know this is happening in places all over Alaska. And it's interesting for me to hear that because I grew up in a small town in North Dakota. My family still lives back there, and I go back to see them as often as I can. The exact same thing is happening in these small rural towns in North Dakota. You know, the kids graduate from high school, and they go to college at, you know, the state university. They move to Fargo or Grand Forks or Bismarck, you know, the big city where they have more opportunities. And so you've got these small rural farming communities out in the middle of the prairie in North Dakota that are dying off. Businesses have left. You know, churches are shutting down because they just don't have the parishioners anymore. The towns are quite literally dying away. So this process is, of course, not unique to Alaska. It's something that seems to be happening everywhere as we become a much more urban society. More people live in cities today than ever before, not just in this country, but worldwide. And that's a process that's likely to continue, likely to accelerate.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and I'm talking to Ross Cohen about the birth of the Alaskan city, and I asked Ross about segregation in the Alaskan city, both 150 years ago and now. The cities are being built, but there is, you know, there's 10,000 years of Alaskan Native culture and history here as these cities are being built. Can you talk about the politics of how these two groups were integrated or not integrated or segregated? Like, what happened in these cities at the time that they were starting to develop?
Yeah, the American period of Alaska from the 1867 purchase forward, those first several decades, and in many ways up to the present day, is a story of segregation. You know, when we think of segregation in the cities, we often think of you know, Mississippi or Alabama or Detroit in the 60s or something like that. Alaska has as much a history of racial and ethnic segregation as any of those places. In Sitka, for example, there was, you know, there was I'm not even sure if I'm going to use the right words here. There was the white half of town, and then there's the Indian village. And there are cases, court cases from the early 1900s, you know, where there's a white school for the white children and there's a native school for the native children, and some native parents or maybe a native mother and a non-native father want their kids to go to the white school because it's a better school. And the discussion, the legal discussion that takes place in a courtroom is whether or not these native children or half-native children are, quote-unquote, civilized enough to attend the white school. And, of course, in most cases, or perhaps even all cases, the decision was that, no, they were not civilized and they needed to stay in the Indian village. Same in Juneau, you know, down on what today is Willoughby Avenue. Way back in the day, that was the Indian village, and not merely the Alaskan Natives, but also the handful of African Americans, for example, who came to Juneau in the early days. They had to live in those segregated places. When we look at it, the history of Anchorage, the city was very segregated. You know, minorities who came to Anchorage would not be given mortgages, bank loans, for example, to live anywhere other than select places, Fairview or Mountain View, you know, places like that. And so these communities grow up and develop really along those segregated lines. And this is something, again, a legacy with which we're still living. And let me reiterate a point that I made before. This is not about assigning blame or suggesting that that people today should be held responsible for this type of segregation. Merely a fact of history that we need to understand when we're evaluating why people, you know, think and act and behave the way they do today. So it's often funny that, you know, here in Alaska we say we don't give a damn how they do it outside, right? We are exceptional. We are unique. We are different from every other place on earth. And yet, when you really examine our history, particularly the history of our cities, we are exactly like every other city down in the lower 48. Even down to the TV shows that we watch, the fast food restaurants that we, you know, the drive-through of which we go through every day, and the manner with which, you know, people have lived or been allowed or restricted to live their lives. We are very much like the lower 48 in ways that I think few Alaskans are really willing to confront and admit.
You've been listening to Sesquicentennial Stories with special guest historian and author Ross Cohen. To read more of his work, go to washington.academia.edu/Ross Cohen, RossCoen. This series is sponsored by the Sitka History Museum and the Sitka Historical Society, with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Sitka Legacy Fund, and KCW Sitka. This series is produced by Mission Man Media. Jeff Budd is the executive producer. I'm Emmett Williams, and thanks for listening.